Hi there, I'm Marco Werman. Every day our program has hundreds of thousands of listeners from all around the globe. If everyone who listened to The World donated during our drive, we'd be set for a while. That's just not possible for everyone. Times are tough. But if you are in a position to give, and if our show has touched you, if it's helped you feel more connected or perhaps more optimistic about the world around you, then please donate today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you very much. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The UN Climate Conference is wrapping up in Glasgow. Signs of progress at COP26. And frustration.
Look, there's been advances made, but it's too slow. And the reality outside of the COP bubble is that this is urgent. The alarms are ringing. People are already dying. And yet the negotiations, they're not protecting people.
Also today, an American journalist in Myanmar is sentenced to 11 years in prison. And a new book looks at how enslaved Africans built American wealth and why that history is often denied.
These are hard things to wrestle with. Everyone, it's a human instinct. Everyone would like to explain their own success by virtuous aspects of their personality or of their history. And it's difficult.
Plus, will one election in Libya solve that country's dysfunction? I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us this Friday. It is set to be a long night in Glasgow, Scotland, as negotiators go into overtime at the COP26 summit. They've made progress, reaching an agreement to double the amount of funding for developing nations to help them adapt to the impacts of climate change. But there's still a lot more to do. The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, has been reporting on all of this and joins me now from Glasgow. I hear last night was also a long one, Carolyn.
It was. Ministers negotiated well past midnight along with the COP president, Alok Sharma, as the summit approached its scheduled deadline of this evening. When I left the events center last night around 10:30, it kind of had the vibe of college kids cramming for an exam. But this morning around 7:30, a draft decision for the summit was released. There is agreement on a lot of issues, but there are still a lot of outstanding issues that need to be hammered out.
Yeah, so tell us more about the big ones that need to be ironed out still before this whole thing is over.
Well, there are three main issues that I want to talk about, and they're all illustrated by things that happened here at the summit today. The first one literally confronted delegates as they were heading into the COP this morning. There was a protest against fossil fuels just outside the gates.
ExxonMobil, BP, Shell, take your filth and go to hell!
The draft decision calls on countries to accelerate the phase-out of unabated coal power and of inefficient subsidies and fossil fuels, which is historic wording in one of these decisions.
This is the 26th meeting of parties, and it's the first time we're seeing fossil fuels in the text, and that's a huge step forward.
That was protester Andrew Nasden. The text right now calls for the phase-out only of inefficient fossil fuel subsidies, and that waters down language that was in a previous draft of the text, and low-lying nations and others are calling for stronger language, including Leah Nicholson, who represents the Alliance for Small Island States.
The call for phasing out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies is weak and does not meet the urgency of the moment.
Okay, so that was sticking point one, illustrated by that protest. Fossil fuels. What else are negotiators still working on?
They're working on something they call ambition, which is trying to keep that goal of 1.5 alive and how quickly they're going to come back to the table to reassess what more they can do. And again, illustrated by a protest. When I walked through security and inside, there was a protest inside, a bunch of people in a snaking line walking and chanting and holding signs. One of the protesters, Joe Dodds, captured the tension that's still here at this point in the negotiations.
Look, there's been advances made, but it's too slow. And the reality outside of the COP bubble is that this is urgent. The alarms are ringing. People are already dying and losing livelihoods, and yet the negotiations, they're not protecting people.
The pledges countries have committed to do not keep warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius. The current draft text requests them to set new targets by next year. Delegates from developing countries are pushing for much stronger language there, requiring especially the big emitters to come back to the table next year.
So fossil fuel subsidies, that's still got to be dealt with. Timing for coming back to the table for the big emitters, what else?
A rather surprising sticking point is funding for damages from climate change. There's a broad coalition of developing and vulnerable countries plus China who are calling on a specific fund for loss and damage, as it's called here at the UN. What is written into the negotiating text now is basically funding a technical body to consult about loss and damage. And around midday today, there was this big, what's called a stock take, where the president of the COP calls all the parties in to sit at these long tables and talk about what they want to see changed in the agreement. And many, many countries raised this funding for loss and damage issue.
We seem to be losing the progress we have made on loss and damage here in Glasgow.
We need specific finance for loss and damage.
What we have in mind here is not giving money to consultants to fly around to come and educate us, teach us about loss and damage.
This issue is too important to settle with a workshop.
Those were representatives from Gabon, Peru, Kenya, and the Marshall Islands speaking.
So finally, Carolyn, besides hectic and harried right before the deadline and a potentially long night, it feels kind of divided there with some frustration.
There are a lot of frustrations. If I were a betting woman, I'd say there's going to be an agreement signed, but I think there are going to be disappointments, especially on behalf of developing and low-lying island nations. But I did feel, sitting in the big meeting earlier today with all the leaders, that they are aware of the world watching them and how history will judge them at this critical moment. Here's U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry.
We have to live up to the expectation of young people who don't want this place just to be a place of words. It has to be, in the next hour, is a place of action.
And they're still working on putting that sentiment to paper right now, Marco.
The World's Carolyn Beeler in Glasgow, Scotland. Thanks very much for checking in with us.
My pleasure, Marco.
As John Kerry said, COP26 can't just be a place of words. There has to be action, and that does depend on language and linguistic diversity. But if many of the world's languages are slowly dying, how will that change how we see and understand the world around us? The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports on an art project that aims to show us what we're losing.
There are 7,000 languages in the world, but about half of those are expected to die off by the end of the century. To Philippa Bailey in the UK, this means we're not just losing words, we're losing whole ways of seeing.
Language grows out of the specifics of a place, you know, so the animals, the plants, the climate, the landscape, are all reflected in the language, but also the relationships between all of the different beings.
When a language disappears, she says, a way to make sense of reality disappears. When a language disappears, a way to interact with nature disappears. So Philippa Bailey and her collaborator Neville Gaby started the Living Language Land Art Project.
In the run-up to COP26, we've been having conversations with people around the world and asking them to share a word with us from their language, if it's a minority and endangered language, that reveals different ways of relating to land and nature, and to tell the story of that word and why it's important to them through the medium that feels most comfortable to them. So people have shared stories through writing, through photographs, through film, and through music and poetry.
Our feet hit the earth like beating the skin of a drum.
Here's the project's co-creator, Neville Gaby.
We got words from Chile, Peru, Colombia, the United States, Canada, Namibia, South Africa, from Scotland, from Wales, the Philippines, Mauritius, Oman. It certainly doesn't cover the whole world, but this is the first step, which was very much designed to have something ready for COP26.
In the run-up to the climate conference, they released 26 words, one word a day, on their social media channels. One of the words was...
Abidal.
Abidal.
Abadul is the Scottish Gaelic word for alphabet, where each letter is represented by a tree. So A is for elm, B is for birch, and so on.
It's such a direct connection. It was extraordinary that the basis of a language can be rooted in our environment and the immediate plants and trees that we find there.
There's even a field in the Outer Hebrides where someone has literally planted all the trees in the Abadul to create a living alphabet we can walk through. The sense that comes through a word like Abadul is that we are enmeshed with nature, not standing in opposition to it, which is what came through during Prime Minister Boris Johnson's speech at the COP26 climate conference. He used the apocalyptic analogy of James Bond defusing a doomsday device at the 11th hour.
We are in roughly the same position, my fellow global leaders, as James Bond today. Except that the tragedy is, this is not a movie.
Philippa Bailey says we are not at war with nature.
Although I totally appreciate the need to talk about the emergency and the crisis that we face, I think starting from a place of connection with nature is so many more things are possible from that place.
And she hopes the Living Language Land Project brings that place just a little bit closer. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Up until a few weeks ago, Sudan was on track towards something different, the possibility of a more democratic future. But the Sudanese military is doubling down on its power grab. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
On Thursday, less than 3 weeks after dissolving Sudan's transitional government, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan went on national television to take an oath of office. He was sworn in as head of Sudan's Sovereign Council again. That's the same body that was meant to lead the country's transition to democratic elections. Leadership of the council was set to switch to civilian leadership, but that was before the military takeover at the end of October. One of the state broadcasters named the members of the new leadership council, but there was no mention of Sudan's prime minister, Abdalla Hamdok. He was leading the government before the military takeover. Now he remains under house arrest, and many of his civilian ministers in the government have been dismissed and replaced by new undersecretaries. Jihad Mashamoun is a Sudanese political analyst based in the UK.
These undersecretaries, a lot of them are aligned to the former regime.
The regime of former President Omar al-Bashir. He had been in power for more than 30 years until 2019, when the military ousted him following popular protests. Mashamoun tells me General al-Burhan's actions suggest that the military is not backing down anytime soon. Attempts at negotiations between the civilian and military sides in Sudan have fallen through in recent weeks.
Because the military did not want to release the people it arrested. And it didn't want to recognize that what it did was a coup, which is actually the sticking point of Prime Minister Hamdok.
But also because many civilian leaders don't want to return to the previous agreement, where civilians were sharing power with the military. They don't trust the generals. Arrests of government officials and activists have continued across the country. To date, many members of the civilian government are still in military custody, including senior political figure Yasser Arman. He's a political advisor to the prime minister. I spoke with his brother, Fattah Arman, who described how he was taken from his home by armed men the day of the coup.
He was barefoot, so they didn't even allow him to put any shoes or even change his pajamas. And there was a blindfold on his eyes.
Up until now, Arman still doesn't know where his brother is or what has happened to him. He tells me that security forces have denied taking him at all.
So we are very worried about his well-being. But again, he's not alone. Many have been arrested, many have been killed. And we are positive that our people and everyone is going to topple this regime.
Protests against the military takeover have continued in the capital Khartoum and across the country. The cost has been high. More than a dozen civilians have been killed by security forces during the protests, according to activists. Many more have been injured. Abdulrahman Hassan Said is a trader in Khartoum.
He says he was shot by security forces while protesting outside of the military headquarters. His doctor says there's only a 25% chance that he will ever walk again. Saeed says he won't stop protesting. We refuse military rule, he says. We want a civilian government that will bring stability. Tomorrow, a march of millions is planned across Sudan. Western nations, including the United States, are calling on security forces to respect the right of free expression without fear of violence or detention. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Enslaved Africans were ripped from their roots, sold and shipped to the Western Hemisphere. Globalized markets exploded. Western empires triumphed. Beyond that narrative, how much do we know about the African side of that history? Frankly, not much, because so many historical accounts don't place Africa at the center of the story. And that's what makes a new book by Howard French remarkable. It's called Born in Blackness. In this poetic passage, French describes how Africans ended up so far away from home.
In some ways, hurricanes serve as an apt metaphor for transatlantic slavery. Just as those systems form on the western fringes of Africa before hurling their energy upon the distant shores of the Americas, the mass traffic in Africans violently yoked together the millions of victims gathered on its western shores before scattering them in the distant hemisphere to the west in sometimes random-seeming ways.
Howard French, former New York Times correspondent and currently a professor of journalism at Columbia University, reading from Born in Blackness. His book covers many centuries and many places, but in the time we had, we focused on the island nation of Sao Tome, tucked in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of West Africa.
Sao Tome is the location where the model of the plantation slave industry, plantation agriculture using chattel slavery. I almost said cattle by accident, but that's a fortuitous coincidence because cattle and chattel share the same root in Latin, and it means beast of burden. And so this is the first place, Sao Tome, where African slaves were exclusively used by Europeans for the production on large-scale plantations of sugar. And then after the birth of this model on Sao Tome in the first decades of the 16th century is transported across the ocean when Brazil was, let's call it, quote unquote, discovered by the Portuguese and implants itself in Brazil and then continues a migration up the chain of the Antilles until it finally, in its last permutation, reaches the United States and we shift from sugar production to cotton production. All of which are using this economic model that was essentially perfected in Sao Tome.
I'm curious, today, what do the people of Sao Tome know about the story of the traffic of enslaved people?
I was struck in visiting there that sites of memory linked to this history are extraordinarily few and poorly elaborated. Only in one specific spot did I really discover not a monument, but a human trace of the story that I'm telling. And it was on the sort of north side of the island where a famous shipwreck takes place early in the 1500s. And the ship crashes on some rocks just off the shore of Sao Tome then. And some of the slaves make it to land somehow. The white people disappear. There's no further record of them. And these slaves set up one of the first so-called maroon or runaway slave societies. They survive in that way, independent of the Portuguese colonizers, for a very long time, and eventually even mount a rebellion in collusion with enslaved Africans on the other part of the island against Portuguese rule.
So despite the interconnectedness of Europe and Africa throughout history, the African side of the story has, unless you go looking for it, been erased, as you say, from the mainstream telling of that history. Why is that?
Part of it is because I think Europeans are aware of the extraordinary horror that attaches to this enterprise, that 12.5 million people survived the Middle Passage and were delivered into slavery in the New World. And these people produced the wealth that separated, for the first time in history, Europe from other older civilizations like in India and in East Asia and China via the exploitation of bonded labor. Europe's wealth grew out of this exploitation, and the very viability of the American colonies, which became the United States, also grew out of this form of exploitation. And these are hard things to wrestle with. Everyone, it's a human instinct. Everyone would like to explain their own success by virtuous aspects of their personality or of their history. And it's difficult to allow for the proper accounting for things so terrible as this. And so I think there's this persistent denial. I also think that part of this is a kind of deliberate separation in the way this history is told between Africans and Africans in the Americas, or what we call today in the United States, African Americans. Artificial divides are maintained in the relating of this history that make it hard to understand how important actually Africa was, how central Africa was to all of this history.
I'm speaking with author Howard French. His new book is Born in Blackness. The title of your book gets at a central theme of this history, the mass othering of people based on the color of their skin, whether it's the Portuguese royals of the early 1400s who first used the African to objectify the people on the continent, or the notion that you bring up of savage to slave. It's the kind of foundational mindset of the enslavement of humans. How has that framing persisted over time and across oceans?
Well, the interesting thing you see when you begin to explore this history in depth is that in the 15th and 16th century, quite remarkably, the Portuguese and some of the other early Europeans who are making commercial exploration of the world of sub-Saharan Africa actually are not predominantly othering Africans to the extent one would imagine today. Africans had diplomatic political relations with European kingdoms. They had representatives in the Vatican, and they had embassies going back and forth between Africa and Western Europe. All of this stuff has been written out of history. Africans from Congo sustained an alliance with Holland to fight what really looks like a world war in the South Atlantic against Spain and Portugal. This alliance was proposed by the Congolese side. These are just extraordinary stories that sort of make the othering you've described impossible to sustain, I would argue. The reason we have arrived at this state of othering is, again, I think, related to the horror that attaches to the entire enterprise, the enterprise of slavery. When one sees the process of converting human beings in such large numbers into beasts of burden and deriving one's wealth and economic success, and by this I mean Western Europe, but also the American colonies, which depend almost entirely on their economic relations with the Caribbean, meaning with slave societies, one is confronted with two choices. One, recognize the horror, or two, find other explanations to kind of mitigate the implications of this for one's own self-image.
Howard, there's an opportunity not to be missed here to unpack the meaning of Bob Marley's anthemic redemption song, both in its content, O Pirates, Yes They Took I, and in his advice, Emancipate Yourself from Mental Slavery. You actually quote it in your book. Remind us what Marley says and why it spoke to you so obviously for this history.
Marley is saying in this particular song and in a number of his songs something that I find potentially revolutionary importance, which is don't take the history which is delivered to you in prepackaged, pre-digested ways for granted. Remember your roots. Try to go to the beginnings of the history. Try to understand things in fundamental ways. Don't allow people to convince you, if you are of African ancestry, that you are worthless, which is what so much of our history for so long has tried to do. Marley, with his own creative genius, keeps coming back to this in his music. And so this is what his call to avoid becoming a victim of mental slavery is all about.
Author Howard French, his new book is called Born in Blackness, Africa, Africans, and the Making of the Modern World, 1471 to the Second World War. Howard, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your interest, Marco.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. NASA is launching a new program to protect us from asteroids. The plan? Throw them off course with a really big push.
About 100 million times harder than the hardest serve of Serena Williams or the hardest home run by Shohei Ohtani or anyone like that.
Also, Myanmar sentences an American journalist to 11 years in prison. We try to understand why. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Tomorrow marks the 6th anniversary of the worst terrorist attack on French soil in the country's modern history. 130 people were killed and hundreds injured in six targeted attacks across Paris on that night in 2015. They were carried out by the Islamic State. The deadliest of those attacks was at the Bataclan Concert Hall. Reporter Rebecca Rossman recently spoke with some survivors about this year's anniversary, which they say feels somewhat different because of a landmark trial taking place.
Rock fanatic Arthur de Nouveau used to be a regular at the Bataclan Concert Hall. Friday, November 13th, 2015, was the first night of a full weekend he planned on spending at the venue.
That was the first of four nights in the Bataclan for me because Deftones was playing the next three nights.
Friday's headliner was the California rock group Eagles of Death Metal. This is a video De Nouveau took of their opening set. The crowd is tightly packed together, jumping up and down with hands up in the air. About 40 minutes into the act, however, De Nouveau heard a popping sound.
You know, like the PA is having some issue or something. And then you realize it's not that, and it's, you know, it could be fireworks, but it's not either.
It was gunfire. Three men armed with assault rifles started shooting into the crowd, killing 90 people.
Édition spéciale.
Fusillade dans le centre de Paris.
Plusieurs explosions ont été entendues.
De Nouveau managed to crawl out of the nearest emergency exit.
First thing you believe is that you're not a victim, but you're a witness. Because obviously, you know, the only injuries I have were very, very minor scratches or bruises. And on the other hand, there are 90 people dead and 300 wounded by bullets. So it takes you a few days, a few panic attacks in public transportation and stuff like that to realize you're a victim.
Journalist Daniel Senny was having a quiet evening at home with some friends when he heard screams coming from outside his window, which faced one of the Bataclan's emergency exits.
Et donc par voyant ce qui se passait, je voyais des gens mourir, tomber.
Seeing what was happening, seeing people dying, my journalistic reflexes kicked in. I filmed the scene, saying to myself, this will serve as evidence of what happened tonight, without really knowing what was going on.
Senny's 13-minute video was published the following day. It's one of the most important records of what happened that night. Senny later took a bullet to the arm while helping one of the victims who had been shot in the leg.
Aujourd'hui à Paris, presque 6 ans après les attentats du 13 novembre, le procès de ces attaques ayant fait 130 morts.
Last month, Senny and De Nouveau both testified during the first phase of the largest trial in modern French history. 9 months, 2,300 plaintiffs, and 300 witnesses, all in a special courtroom built to accommodate its tremendous scale. Even François Hollande, who was president at the time, testified as a witness earlier this week, per the request of the victims.
Mon message principal, c'était de dire, voilà, ce que c'est qu'une démocratie, elle est capable d'organiser un procès.
Speaking on French television shortly after his testimony, Hollande said his main goal was to show that in a democracy, you can have such a fair trial, where the accused have lawyers, and where even a former president can have the right to speak. The 20 defendants include Salah Abdeslam, the sole surviving attacker from that night, who so far has shown no remorse for his actions. Still, Daniel Senny said the chance to give his testimony in front of the accused felt like a moment of catharsis.
Qui permet à toute la population française, mais aussi aux accusés.
It forces the accused to see and hear the horror of what they have sown, he says. And for the victims, it feels like we are finally turning a page. Mathieu Souk is a journalist for the French investigative website Mediapart who covered the aftermath of the November 2015 attacks and has been writing about the trial.
Là aussi, c'est un peu unique ce procès parce que pour le 11 septembre, il n'y a pas eu de.
He says unlike other large-scale attacks like September 11th or the London or Madrid bombings, this is the first time where terrorists are being put on the stand in front of hundreds of their victims, meaning we need to be prudent about the fact that we don't have that much hindsight as to how victims will process this. But like Daniel Senny, Arthur de Nouveau says he felt a sense of relief on the witness stand. Today, de Nouveau is the president of a victim support group called Life for Paris.
One of the messages we had all the previous years was, please, please keep a good memory of what happened that night. Don't forget any place, don't forget any restaurant, don't forget any terraces, don't forget the Stade de France. And I think we don't have to do that anymore because the trial has done it once and for all.
Denuveau says he's looking forward to when the trial closes next May, which is when he and other victims can begin to let go of the painful memories. For The World, Rebecca Rossman, Paris.
It's been nearly a month since 17 North American missionaries were abducted in Haiti. Negotiations for their release continue to drag on. The kidnappers, members of a local gang, are demanding $1 million per hostage. A spree of kidnappings in Haiti has paralyzed parts of the country. Gangs are targeting high-profile Haitians, including lawyers, doctors, and university professors. The ability of Haiti's government to respond adequately remains hobbled by the July assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. It's estimated that gangs now control half of the Haitian capital and surrounding areas. Those gangs are not just holding people hostage, they're also blocking access to fuel, which has in turn forced businesses and schools to shutter, which has only led to more chaos and desperation. Vice President Kamala Harris is in Paris this week with a few assignments. Today she's representing the U.S. at a peace summit on Libya. One goal is to bolster support for free and fair elections there in December. Many analysts, though, are skeptical that elections can stabilize Libya. Among them is Emadeddin Badi. He's a senior fellow with the Atlantic Council and joins us from Toronto. So in 2011, let's remember, longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown in uprisings that were part of the Arab Spring. Who has been in charge since then, and who are the main players fighting over power right now?
There have been successive transitional governments since 2011, but I would say that a major flashpoint occurred in 2014 when effectively the country relapsed into another civil war and has become effectively institutionally divided with an interim government in eastern Libya and a government in western Libya that was UN recognized. That situation kind of institutional division persisted until in 2019, Khalifa Haftar launched an offensive to kind of take control over the western capital of Tripoli.
And Haftar is kind of a general, right?
Exactly. Haftar is a general from eastern Libya that effectively leveraged before his territorial control over the interim government. And after the failure of that offensive, due to primarily Turkish and Russian stalemate, a political dialogue happened and a new government came in that was supposed to unify the country. Now, that roadmap, which brought that government, also stipulated that elections would happen on December 24th. And the basis for these elections now are contested. And that's what part of the reason why this Paris summit happened, is to reinforce kind of the international consensus that they should happen.
I mean, we're talking about the ability of elections to stabilize Libya, but I'm wondering if you think Libya can even hold an election right now. I mean, how's that going to work?
There are a lot of other structural facets that would affect an election being held. First of all, we don't have a strong judiciary. Media is definitely not independent. The Higher National Electoral Commission cannot enforce a lot of the rules that have been put in place for the elections. Aside that, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the military is not unified, which has its comes with its own set of problems, kind of even in terms of securing the elections in a de facto divided country. So there are a lot of structural problems that haven't been dealt with domestically.
So Vice President Harris is in Paris at the summit, but what else can the White House, the Biden administration do at this point to bring stability to the country?
I think the problematic aspect of the U.S. is it's also pushing at these elections at any cost, which is quite a problematic track. I think ideally the U.S. could have been the kind of level-headed player, which isn't directly affected by Libya, but Libya still matters to it by virtue of its geographic location. And actually reconvened the either the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum or the political players in some way, shape, or form to actually address this contested basis for elections.
Emadeddin, what I'm hearing you saying is that elections are not the answer for Libya, not right now anyway. So if holding elections won't bring stability, what or who can?
That is actually the problem, is that the equation became elections on the 24th of December being the answer. And elections aren't an end point of a policy. They should be part of a larger process. There should be some substance behind them. There should be some agreements as to what should be done before, after, about their constitutionality. And I'm saying this both domestically, but also internationally, because the international kind of dimension and the foreign players is as guilty almost as a lot of the Libyan stakeholders that have tanked the transition. So yes to elections, but not in the way that they're currently being engineered, which would actually be counterproductive on several fronts.
What will that mean? Further conflict for Libya?
I think all the parties are actually positioning themselves to either profit from flawed elections or provide themselves or rehabilitate themselves with a new kind of raison d'être, or by virtue of them or these elections collapsing. I think by virtue of the foreign interveners ironically being present, the prospect of a full-blown conflict in like urban towns is kind of dashed, but that doesn't mean that the situation can't become worse, because a lot of these foreign interveners also don't care about the country being effectively governed. So you could end up with a de facto partition or a actual real partition, a state of institutional division where the actual citizens of the country bear the brunt of the nefarious effects of that, basically. So I wouldn't say that the issue will be another conflict unless, let's say, Turkey, Russia, and the UAE decide that an open confrontation is beneficial to them, but I don't see that happening.
Imadeddin Badi is a Libyan political analyst and senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. He's been speaking with us from Toronto. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thanks.
The U.S. evacuation from Afghanistan may be over, but not our coverage. To hear and read more, hop on over to theworld.org, where you'll find it all, including reporter Shirin Jafari's coverage of Afghans who rushed to flee the Taliban, their quick decisions about what to pack in a small bag or backpack, and where they are now. Thousands of Afghans in limbo, waiting to know what their future holds. Again, that's over at theworld.org. Last February, as you will recall, the military in Myanmar took control of the government and arrested leaders of the ruling party, including Aung San Suu Kyi. Violent street protests and mass arrests followed. Among the reporters covering the coup and its aftermath was American journalist Danny Fenster, managing editor of Frontier Myanmar, a top independent news site. He was detained. Today, Danny Fenster was sentenced to 11 years in prison. Here to talk about Fenster's case is Derek Mitchell, U.S. ambassador to Myanmar during the Obama administration. Ambassador, what can you tell us about why Danny Fenster was initially arrested?
Well, the military claims that he was trying to escape. He was at the airport trying to go back to see his family and just to get out of the conditions in Myanmar, which were deteriorating. And they had him on a list that suggested that he had worked for a journalistic enterprise that they considered to have insulted the military, had violated rules, and they decided to keep him.
So his sentence, delivered by a military court, it does seem harsh, 11 years for unlawful association with an illegal group and circulating comments that, quote, cause fear or spread false news. What does that say about Myanmar's military government?
Well, they act with impunity. I mean, even if, in fact, they got somebody, they held somebody that was innocent, according to the charges that were directly put against him, they have to keep going. They can't admit mistakes. It was inevitable that he was going to be charged and sentenced, but it shows a disregard for justice. They are the law, and once held, you are convicted.
So last week, former governor and UN ambassador Bill Richardson was negotiating for Danny Fenster's release. That did not happen, obviously. There's speculation now that Fenster has become a political hostage or a negotiating pawn. Do you think there's anything to that?
It certainly could be the case. I mean, the Chinese have done that recently. It's not unknown for countries to do that these days. Another thing is, once you are convicted, you are eligible for parole. And occasionally they'll have moments, usually on holidays or certain events of the year, where they release prisoners. So in a strange way, this can be progress because they're not going to release folks who are charged before they are convicted. But we don't know, as you suggest, whether he might be one of those they just decide to keep handy to use as leverage as the United States engages in other ways with the Myanmar junta.
We should note that some 30 other journalists are behind bars in Myanmar right now, which means a lot of reporting about the country is not getting done. How firm a grip on the media does the government have?
They have a complete grip. I mean, they've shut down all independent media, all independent voices. They not only have held media people, they've 1,200 political prisoners now and growing by the day. They feel that they have to shut down information, that they have to succeed. Again, they feel like they are the law. And it is very difficult to have any independent journalism through mainstream methods, but there is information that is getting out through a variety of other methods.
What avenues are still open for the U.S. to work for Fenster to be released?
It's not a lot. I know that they have been working this hard from the beginning. The State Department has taken on this case in consultation with Danny Fenster's family, and they bring it up at every opportunity. So we're trying to leverage whatever they can to say this is not going to help the junta get what they desire, which is recognition or any kind of credibility. I'm not sure even releasing him will get much for the junta, because they shouldn't have taken him to begin with. But it certainly doesn't make things better for them to hold him. And there's not a lot of more leverage that can be imposed than is sought to be imposed generally on an awful situation.
Well, that's not really encouraging. When you served as U.S. ambassador to Myanmar, you were dealing with a military government that had held power for 40 years. Then the opening up to the West kind of started happening, was seen as promising back then. But the events of this year seem to have kind of eclipsed all that. Where do you see Myanmar heading?
It's hard to see much positive going forward. I hate to say it. There has to be some kind of rapprochement, some kind of dialogue established between the people of the country and this institution that continues to impose itself. And it's very sad to watch, but one hopes that someone will, you know, within the military, will reach out at least quietly for dialogue to put the country on a better track.
Derek Mitchell, former U.S. ambassador to Myanmar and president of the National Democratic Institute, speaking with us about the case of American journalist Danny Fenster, who was sentenced to 11 years in prison today by a military court in Myanmar. Ambassador, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Among the potential catastrophes facing planet Earth, we don't often consider collision with an asteroid.
This new one you're tracking, how big?
It's the size of Texas, Mr. President. It's what we call a global killer, the end of mankind.
In the movie Armageddon, Bruce Willis stops an asteroid by blowing it up. Now NASA is planning its own solution, and it is not sci-fi. It goes by the tantalizing name, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, or DART, a collaboration between NASA, Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Laboratory, and SpaceX, Elon Musk's company. It launches in 11 days. The plan is simple but audacious: move an asteroid and change its path. Joining me now is scientist Andy Rivkin, one of DART's investigation team leads. So tell us how this project got started, Andy.
The recognition that asteroid impacts are something that not only humanity would have to worry about on long timescales, but something that humanity could do something about has been emerging over the past few decades. And we have a few tools in our toolbox that we could choose to use. They do sound kind of sci-fi and movie-ish. They do involve large nuclear devices. So we wanted to develop more things that we could use. So the idea of using a kinetic impactor, which is basically just a spacecraft to ram into an asteroid to change its orbit, has been out there for a little while. And this is the next step in validating it and making it a technique that we could actually use and trust and know how to use. God forbid it came to it.
So you're looking at these two asteroids, this Dimorphos, that's a satellite asteroid, and then there's a main asteroid. So what are you actually testing here?
Yeah, we are going to impact the asteroid Dimorphos, which is a satellite of the main body Didymos. Dimorphos orbits Didymos every 12 hours. By impacting it, we're going to change the speed of Dimorphos around Didymos and change its orbit period from about 12 hours to something more like 11 hours and 45 minutes, something like that. This mimics what we would want to do in real life, where we would want to change the speed of an asteroid going around the sun. If we thought it was going to hit the Earth, changing the speed of that asteroid around the sun changes its orbit. And if we can do it at the right time, then that orbit would then miss the Earth instead of intersect the Earth.
Tell us more about the DART spacecraft that you're using to slam into the asteroid. What can you tell us about its design?
DART is about the size of a vending machine without counting its solar panels. The solar panels are rolled up right now. We have one instrument. It's a camera. And that will be taking pictures of the system, sending them to the targeting computer, I guess, for those Star Wars fans. And it'll calculate where Didymos and Dimorphos are in the frame and steer the spacecraft in.
Andy, you said the spacecraft is about the size of a vending machine. I'm surprised that's sizable enough to actually change the path of the asteroid.
Coming in, there's two parts to momentum. There's the mass that you're coming in with, and then there's the speed. DART is going to hit Dimorphos about 100 million times harder than the hardest serve of Serena Williams or the hardest, you know, home run by Shohei Ohtani or anyone like that. Something the size of DART can change the speed by enough that if we had 20 or 30 years warning, we'd be able to avoid an impact on Earth.
I'm speaking with scientist Andy Rifkin, the lead investigator for DART, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test. So if, as in Armageddon, we were facing an asteroid the size of Texas, what kind of damage would that do?
Whoa, boy. Well, something the size of Texas, we know of one asteroid that's that big. It's out happily between Mars and Jupiter. It's not going anywhere. That's the asteroid Ceres. The Dawn mission visited that. If you want to do the hypothetical of what if something that big actually were to hit the Earth. So that would be absolute, utter disaster for life on Earth. We have zero indication that anything like that is going to happen, has happened in the last 4.5 billion years, is going to happen in the next 4.5 billion years.
So this is not the kind of thing that keeps you up at night.
No. What keeps me up at night is kind of being psyched, thinking about all the cool stuff we're doing.
Like what? I mean, what keeps you passionate about your work every day?
You know, my colleagues and I sometimes look at some of the really big problems that face the world and face civilization, face humankind. We have plenty of colleagues that work on climate change issues, for instance, and there's a direct connection to those problems, people who are working on that. This provides a way for us to work on things that have clear benefit to humankind. Hopefully, we will never have to actually carry out these techniques. Hopefully, we will never be faced with the kind of danger that would require us to launch something like DART for real. But having an insurance policy, doing the sorts of things that can let us say, okay, this is a good thing. This is something that has a practical impact, no pun intended, that that people could, if 300 years from now, 600 years from now, whatever, people might go back to our work and say, okay, people have thought about this. People have given us a good foundation to work from. Something you might learn in one place might pop up someplace totally different unexpectedly and have a big effect.
I was asking you about the video of the collision. There's something kind of thrilling about seeing stuff smashed together in space. Does that kind of also move you? I mean, it's like it gets my little kid kind of vibe going.
Yeah, it's funny. There's a lot of recent spacecraft have been anthropomorphized. You know, people talk about the rovers and save the rovers, and people get really sad when they meet their demise. We've been trying consciously to not anthropomorphize DART because we know what we're going to do to it. and we don't want to break the hearts of little kids all around the world. But there is definitely a thrill that comes with that, a thrill that comes not only with, you know, a satisfaction with something well done, and now we're done with it, and it's going to, you know, we're finished. And sure, you know, as someone who plays softball, given something a good whack has
yes.
some appeal. And there's also definitely a thrill that I know the engineers are feeling. We get one shot at this, and we're going to steer it in, and it's going to be hitting a rock from very far away, moving very fast. So it's going to be quite a challenge, but I'm sure the team's up for it.
So, Andy, I know you're also a musician, and you've even written a song about DART.
It's trying out orbital correction. The mission goes by the name of DART.
So does the creative outlet of music kind of impact your work in any way, or is it the other way around?
Oh, well, I think just creativity in general, I think that both science and the music either force or allow me to think in ways other than the routine. They both help me kind of stay out of a rut. And so if I've got my creative side going in one direction or for one reason, it often will help the other. Whether it's chicken and egg, you know, which one I start with will vary.
Andy Rifkin is one of DART's investigation team leads, speaking with us about the world's first planetary defense mission. Thank you very much, Andy. Great to meet you. Great to hear what you're doing.
Thanks for having me.
The mission goes by the name of DART, that double asteroid redirection test. And just one flick should do the trick. Just one nudge and those things would budge. A little poke, not going for broke, would avoid those problems.
DART to infinity and beyond. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Y'all have a great weekend.
So when hazards come, we can resist them.
From PRX.